Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Should every building from the mid-century modern period be saved, especially if it stands in the way of a new Frank Gehry building?
We have to choose our battles, and there's certain cases like this one that are extremely difficult. It's a great building, but I think the cutoff is whether it's an extraordinary building.
Hear from Sam Lubell later in the show. Now, more changes are coming to downtown LA. News has broken that Danish architect Bjarke Ingels will design a huge mixed-use project for the Arts District. This comes hot on the heels of news of Herzog & de Meuron's massive project at 6th and Alameda. Right now, though, the fatal fire at Oakland's Ghost Ship has led to evictions of artists who've been occupying warehouse spaces in LA and other cities. DNA producer Avishai Artsy met with some of the artists.
Dennis Turley has a studio in a space called Big Art Factory. It's a warehouse that's roughly 70,000 square feet in a formerly industrial area between Chinatown and Lincoln Heights.
The reason why we're being asked to leave is the spaces were built without having permit. So in order to get the permits done, it's just going to cost too much. And the landlords, from what I hear, are not hip to it. So they would rather just see it dissolve.
Turley works with glass, wood, and metal and says he's complained about the lack of ventilation in his studio. He says that's been a problem in most studios he's worked in. But 1 week after the Oakland fire, inspectors from the LA Fire Department came knocking.
The main concerns that the fire department had were really minuscule, actually. Is extension cords being used as permanent wiring, and to say that they have to terminate the lease is kind of like actually out of line a little bit.
Turley says he and others had at one point been living in the warehouse, but are not living there anymore. The artists were renting their spaces from Dan Lowry, the leaseholder. Incidentally, his professional name is Dan Dasman, and the New York Times has described his creations as, quote, monumental sculpture set ablaze and capped by fireworks and explosions. The owner of the building is OmniNet Capital, a real estate investment company based in Beverly Hills. The day after fire inspectors visited on December 9th, OmniNet terminated Lowry's lease. A representative of OmniNet claimed to have been unaware that Lowry had subleased units in the building, even though they'd been receiving citations for unlawful alcohol sales, unpermitted parties, and municipal code violations. On December 14th, Lowry notified all his tenants that they had 30 days to vacate. Eric Fisher is a metal fabricator who's had a studio at Big Art Factory for 5 years.
They gave us a list of things to fix that was very reasonable. The owners didn't feel as if it was worth it to keep us here. So I think that's not nearly as sad as the loss of life, but it's a sad legacy for the people whose lives were lost that small businesses are getting shut down. Because I think artists essentially are small businesses.
This is not an isolated incident. An underground music and art venue called Purple 33 in a warehouse in Culver City was ordered by inspectors to shut down following the Oakland fire. Other spaces like Rhinoceropolis in Denver and the Bell Foundry in Baltimore have also been ordered shuttered. There's widespread anxiety among LA's artist community that more evictions are coming.
That was DNA producer Avishai Artsy. I'm Frances Anderton. From the vantage point of renters being evicted, living in a potentially unsafe warehouse space is better than no home and often feels like a creative alternative to a regular home. But the authorities have different priorities. Mike Fuhrer is city attorney for the city of Los Angeles.
In the immediate aftermath of the fire in Oakland, we've taken a number of steps to be sure that here in Los Angeles, we avert a similar tragedy. Even before that fire began, our office was working on a case that I think is indicative of the broader problem. There's a warehouse in downtown Los Angeles, which is permitted for commercial use, but nonetheless, it has a number of people living in unpermitted apartments in it. Over the course of the last number of months, there were inspections by the fire department and building and safety department that revealed a number of alleged violations of important fire and safety codes. The result of those inspections and notices of violations was ultimately that the owner was ordered to comply with the law. and in large measure failed to do so. So recently we moved to prosecute the owner. But we need to be sure that the tenants, who as far as I know were unaware that the units were unpermitted, unaware of the violations, don't become unwitting victims of the enforcement process. We also convened a meeting with the fire chief, key building and safety leaders, the LAPD. And one of the outcomes of that meeting was an agreement that we should be striving to find a new model of enforcement to the extent we have the resources to do it, where we look at commercial properties, which are likely to have unpermitted tenancies in them for residents, and inspect them before there is a complaint or a referral. And in addition, assuring that if a tenant does find themselves in that situation, that they have the relocation benefits necessary to live in a safe place. Because, Francis, at the end of the day, it should never be the case that any tenant is put to the choice of living in affordable housing or safe housing. Every tenant deserves both.
It's really tricky because on the one hand, as you've just laid out, you want to preempt any kind of disaster happening. On the other hand, do you want to see a sort of cascade of people being evicted around the holidays by landlords or owners who don't want to be investigated by your office?
I think it's a very complex issue, to be sure. But if let's take a warehouse owner who has not taken the effort to change the use, there's a method to do that under city law, who has not undertaken to assure that the electricity is up to code, that there aren't flammable materials pervading their building, that hasn't made sure that there are fire alarms or sprinklers or fire escapes that are accessible to everybody. If that owner is saying, well, in light of the fact that I failed to take those steps, I really shouldn't have tenants living in my building, perhaps that's a responsible step to take. Obviously, the conundrum that we're talking about is there isn't enough housing in the city, and that is a struggle for all of us. But I just can't imagine anybody in this city saying, if the building is truly a dangerous threat to safety for its residents, we want people to live there.
That was Mike Feuer, city attorney for the City of Los Angeles. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. So is the emptying out of warehouses by landlords in reaction to the Oakland fire the biggest worry to folks living in LA's warehouse spaces? Well, not necessarily. Shane Anise Dambrot is an art critic living in downtown, and she says she knows a lot of people who are worried, though many feel more threatened by developers than by government inspectors.
It's been a hot topic of conversation. What is going to happen to artists who are living in these sort of, let's say, partially permitted kind of situations where maybe it's zoned for live work, but you know, that doesn't necessarily mean they want 10 people in 2,000 square feet, you know, with dividers. And so it's a kind of a gray area. But the consensus of the conversation seems to be that what's happening is more like the events in Oakland are triggering fears among artists because landlords are worried about their liability. They're worried about being sued or arrested for what may have been sort of letting a few things go in a friendly manner that may even have been genuinely being supportive of, you know, sort of artist lifestyles, but now they're worried. And then finally, there is this worry, and I think it's very real, that developers who have their eyes on these parts of town are going to be able to kind of leverage this perception of unsafe conditions in their bids to make further incursions into this part of town.
Now, Bjarke Ingels, he's one of the world's sort of starriest architects right now, and news has just broken that he's been tapped to design a kind of a mega project in the Arts District. On the one hand, it's the scale of development that is making people feel nervous and see yet more visions of gentrification and being priced out. On the other hand, it's an architect who is very current and very interesting. And wouldn't it be exciting to have a building designed by Bjarke Ingels in the Arts District? What's your view on that dichotomy?
That's the sort of other side of it is for people who are interested in culture and Los Angeles being a hub of contemporary culture, architecture is a huge feature of that. So, okay, we have Frank Gehry because, you know, he lives here and he's, you know, sort of ours, right? And we have other amazing architects. But we obviously, as architecture aficionados, are excited about news like that or the Herzog and de Meuron development on the corner of Six that was being buzzed about a couple of months ago. And I mean, I think a lot about, you know, sort of Robert Moses in New York or Haussmann in Paris, where, you know, areas were bulldozed, but it created the iconic cities that people subsequently, you know, fell in love with. So there's this whole conversation where it's the best news ever.
The best and the worst.
Right. The best and the worst. I'm sad because I know people that I care about are going to lose their homes, but I can't wait to see what some of this incredibly progressive 21st century architecture is going to look like here in downtown Los Angeles. And I feel both ways at the same time.
That's art critic Shana Nisdambrot. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. And you just heard us mention Bjarke Ingels, architect of the proposed 670 Mesquite project for the Arts District. The big question, however, is will this project get built? Right now, resistance to development across Los Angeles, whoever designs it, is strong. Coming up after this break, the city approved a large project designed by Frank Gehry, but a mid-century bank building just might stop progress. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. 8150 Sunset is a proposed five-structure development designed by architect Frank Gehry for developer Townscape Partners. Its site is the eastern edge of the Sunset Strip, between Havenhurst and Crescent Heights at the border of LA and West Hollywood. In late October, the project won council approval after 2 years of struggles over its height, its density, traffic impacts, and the quantity of affordable housing. Now it faces a new obstacle. Currently on the site is the Lytton Savings Bank. That's a modernist building with a folded plate concrete roof. Imagine a zigzag profile that was designed by the late Kurt Meyer. The LA Conservancy says the design, quote, exemplifies a transformative shift in bank design after World War II. And together with a group called Friends of Lytton Savings has just won a battle to have the building be given a historic designation. Now, what does this mean for the Gehry project? And should the bank building be saved? Esteban Montemayor is spokesperson for Councilman David Rue, the buildings in his district.
Well, it requires the developers and their team to go through an oversight process that will be administered by the cultural heritage staff and the commission. And it will require them to explore all options for preservation. Those options had already been identified in the EIR that was approved when the 8150 Sunset Project was approved before City Council. But this mechanism, the designation, requires the developers to have some oversight as they move forward.
And what are the options? Do the options involve making sure the building stays there?
Well, that option was looked at in their EIR, but given the fact that Mr. Gehry and the developers have made it clear that they don't believe that the bank should stay there and they'd like to make room for their project, there are two other options that are possible. One would be relocation. That would need to be studied. The cost would need to be studied. The other option could be taking aspects of the bank that have been called out and incorporating them into either the project at 8150 Sunset or elsewhere. For instance, the EIR called out the stained glass windows that are inside the bank itself. Also on the property of the bank is a art sculpture that has been identified as significant. And lastly, the waffle roof is something that has been identified as significant as well by many preservationists. So Mr. Gehry, during the hearing, during 8150, had alluded to paying homage to Kurt Meyer, the architect of the bank, in some way. He didn't go into full detail as of how he would do that. However, he made it clear he wanted to do some sort of tribute. It's the council member's opinion that all preservation options should be explored, and if it is possible to incorporate elements of the bank into the project that has been approved, then that's something, you know, that would be very interesting. Or if it's possible to relocate the bank as well, that's a great way to preserve our city's history.
For the architect Frank Gehry himself, things change. He has seen some of his own buildings torn down or altered over the years. And besides, he says, Meyer's bank replaced a previous beloved building.
When I got to L.A., I was about 17 or 8, 17, I think. And in my looking around the city, I vividly remember the Garden of Allah Hotel, which I later found out was a haven for fancy people. And I remember it well on that street, and it seemed to fit nicely. And then along came this big bad guy, Bartlett, and he sort of bulldozed around and got things approved. And he got the building torn down so he could use it for his bank, for Lytton Savings and Loan. And then he put his bank right smack on Sunset Boulevard, so it makes it very difficult to build anything on the site. So that's what we're trying to do, to find a new paradigm, new way to look at that site that could be sneakily evocative of the Garden of Allah.
That's architect Frank Gehry. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Sam Lubell is author of a new book called Mid-Century Modern Architecture Travel Guide, West Coast, USA. So we turn to him for his opinion on the Lytton Savings Bank. It turns out he did not include it in his guide.
Obviously, I've spent a lot of time looking at and exploring and really appreciating mid-century modern architecture, and I love it. I think it's California's single most important contribution to the architectural world. And I think whenever possible, I am in favor of saving mid-century architecture. But that being said, we have to choose our battles. There's certain cases like this one that are extremely difficult. It's a great building, but I think the cutoff is whether it's an extraordinary building, whether it's important enough to block what I think will be actually an extraordinary building by the city's premier architect, Frank Gehry. And that to me is that's the tipping point, is not just that I think this building is good, but not extraordinary, but I also think the location is important because this is sort of the gateway to the Sunset Strip, and to have something that sort of reflects that is important for the city now. Those two factors outweigh how much I really do love this building. I think it's a great building, but you do have to make that choice.
What makes this building good but not extraordinary?
Well, that's a really tough call. I mean, I think in a lot of ways for me, that's sometimes it comes down to, is it part of the lexicon and something that stands the test of time, and something that will, you know, is remarkable and stands on its own as something that is important for architects and cultural historians. It's a good bank, it's a good building, but it doesn't set itself apart from other amazing mid-century banks in California. It isn't something that I would say you have to visit, because to me it's a good example of mid-century bank architecture versus something that is the example of mid-century bank architecture.
So you are the author of the Mid-Century Modern Architecture Travel Guide. How did you make your selections for what made the cut for the guide?
Well, I think we wanted to mix it between buildings that were essential knowledge historically and architecturally that we thought people really needed to know to really get proper grounding in architecture in the area. And I love mixing buildings that were part of the historical lexicon with surprises.
Single out, if you will, one or two of the surprises that people might find in your guide.
I mean, there's so many. I think one of the great surprises, I think, is San Diego as a city is an incredible surprise. There's just so many people don't even think about its modernist architecture. But if you start with the Salk Institute and then you go across the street to the Geisel Library at UCSD, and then, you know, you move into all these buildings by William Kreisel and buildings by apprentices of Frank Lloyd Wright and Kendrick Spagg Kellogg, just amazing diversity, and you got tiki architecture, and people don't even know about that at all. And so that, to me, the city itself is a surprise for modernism. And in LA, there's just so many incredible surprises. You have campuses, you know, like Quincy Jones did the whole campus for the Cal State Dominguez Hills, which is right near Watts, and nobody's even, you know, heard of this campus, and it's an incredible example of brutalist architecture.
Your book sort of suggests that modernism became kind of almost like California's house style. Why was that, and what makes it so enduring?
Well, I think, you know, people have always tried to figure out what is the style of California or of the West Coast. And, you know, people have tried to borrow things from colonial architecture and from Europe and from everywhere. But the only thing, I think the architecture that really suits this place the best is modernism. It is a style that came from Europe, but it was really adapted to California exquisitely. Just also, first of all, to the mindset of innovation and progress. And really, you know, you can think of buildings like the Dean Building at LAX really representing the future and moving forward, and all these case study houses, which are rethinking the way people live, moving inside and outside. And it really just reflects the spirit in the place, and also the open spaces and the glass and the way that they a lot of these buildings really defer to the landscape and open to the landscape is perfect for a place like the West Coast, where the climate is right for that and the landscape is so beautiful to be able to really maximize that. It just suits this area so well. And it's astonishing what was achieved and the innovative thinking that was put into the building. It's really unlike almost any other series of buildings in the world.
And lastly, there's been a 25-year-long ongoing revival of interest in mid-century. Why does the revival seem to never end?
It's true. It just seems to grow and grow. I think there's layers to it. I think first people just started out by just being kind of curious about it, and then, you know, looking at some old pictures of it, and then there's some books about, you know, the architecture that was documented by Julia Shulman, and people started to buy books and art. And then there's, you know, television shows like Mad Men and a series of others that made people nostalgic and really wonder. And now I think it's getting even deeper, and that's where I think guides like this come in, and people actually want to go see this architecture, and then they really can understand it. And for me, it was revelatory, because I'd always liked this style, and I've always seen it living in LA for a long time and enjoyed it. But to really, you know, visit as much as I possibly could, it just changed my understanding of how incredible the talent was and incredibly well-suited this architecture was to the area. And it really was a progressive, you know, innovative thing. It was trying to create something different and create something for most people, for the masses of people that lived here, not just for the very rich. And it really has this sense that we're going to rethink architecture, we're going to rethink how people live, and we're going to create something new. And that's sort of what the West Coast is to me, and still has that feeling to me.
Sam Lubell is author of the new Mid-Century Modern Architecture Travel Guide, West Coast USA. It shows a wide range of buildings, public and private, spanning the coast from San Diego to Seattle and from early case study houses through to 1970s brutalist gems. He's picked buildings that tourists can enter mostly at no cost or check them out from outside. And while on the topic of mid-century modern Californian architecture, I want to end this show by recognizing an Angelina who helped bring attention to one of our most beloved designers of the era. Betty Jane Cohen was a fledgling filmmaker and a student of architecture at SIARC when she happened to tour a house designed by John Lautner. Now, he's the creator of the Chemosphere House, Silvertop, the Elrod House, and other spectacular buildings. This was the late 1980s, and many of his incredible homes were in states of disrepair, and they were selling for relatively modest prices. Cohen recognized that both the man and the architecture were extraordinary, and that since no one had made a film about him, she decided that she should be the one to do so. So she applied for grants and tapped friends and family for support, and bit by bit, she got it made. She called the film The Spirit in Architecture, John Lautner. and she told DNA earlier this year about meeting John for the first time.
I was very nervous to, in fact, meet him and to get the permission for making the film, because I had already started writing a grant. But once I met him, I just knew that we could work together. So he was very genuine. And actually, the thing, I gave him my proposal and he goes, well, seems like a worthwhile project and you seem tall enough to do it. And that was it. We just worked together ever since.
So Betty, let's get to the heart of the matter, which is embodied in the title of the film, The Spirit in Architecture. Why was the movie called that? What did spirit mean in John's work?
For me, it has to do with the feeling that you get walking into a building and when you're inside of it. And for me, it's sort of like an aliveness. But I know when I interviewed John in the Sheets Goldstein house, he did talk about the spirit in architecture.
In architecture, it's an extremely subtle kind of thing where you have to design, whether it's angular or curved or whatever, the proportions at a certain point with a certain juxtaposition, they have a spirit, they have a feeling, they have a life.
It was just something I think that moves people, that in some buildings have it and some buildings don't. And his buildings seem to have it.
This interview with Betty Jane Cohen was conducted in spring of this year. She was at work on a 25-year anniversary edition of Spirit in Architecture, knowing that her own time was shortening. After a long illness, she passed on October 19th at the age of 62. I first met Betty Jane soon after arriving in LA 25 years ago when she was doing early screenings of her movie, and she herself had a special spirit. She was indeed very tall, very determined, and at the same time very gentle and kind, which perhaps made her a kindred spirit for the towering bear-like John Lautner, who could be both gruff and sweet. John was still alive at that point, and he was just beginning to enjoy the fruits of a renewed interest in his work, a revival that was in large part thanks to Betty Jane's tireless work making the documentary and making sure it got seen. Most recently, she was working on a documentary about the Swiss architect Albert Frey, who spent much of his career in Palm Springs. Betty Jane Cohen and her work will be celebrated next February at Modernism Week in Palm Springs. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Jackie Liu. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.